When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is your host, Kevin Pollak. Thanks so much for coming back to yet another episode of my Mrs. Maisel pod. How have you been? Did you enjoy the last episode? Are you listening to them in succession? Do you watch Succession? Write to us at mymrsmaiselpod@gmail.com. I love reading your emails. I will read one of the email questions within the body of this episode, as opposed to part of the wraparound at the end. There will be a wraparound at the end, but it won't include because I asked it directly to Jane. I found one in the bag, and then while I was talking with her, I thought, hey, I've got her here. Why not just... So, it's from Steve. And that'll come at the end of this interview. Man, I just love Jane Lynch so very, very much in every way. And it comes through. But this is an especially great part three to our chat. She really, I hate to use the overused term, deep dive, but there's a sense of loving and enthusiasm when she shares insights about the inner workings and the inner thought process, both as an actress, but also of the character Sophie Lennon, through specific scenes that I can't wait for you to hear. So I'm going to shut up now and let's get to episode 49 of this here podcast with the multi-award winning Jane Lynch. Part three. Enjoy. From that scene, oddly, we go to Moishe's kitchen table, where I do some of the best head-in-hand acting I've ever done.
Slamming the head on the table and the phone comes off. And you're surrounded in harvest gold.
Right?
Which was a very, very popular color at that time for a kitchen.
Oh, is that right?
Avocado green.
Oh, yeah.
There was, and then harvest gold.
Oh, yeah.
So you had the harvest gold phone and the kind of like brown and harvest gold tablecloth. And right. I forget what color robe you were wearing, but I'm sure it was Donna picked one that worked.
Yeah, she did. And yeah. I'm going to say, for no particular reason, it's raining outside. Mm-hmm. But the reason it doesn't matter on his side, you get very clear on the other end of the phone where Midge is, because they're playing the rain dripping through the ceiling of the backstage area.
Right. She's at the, whatchamacallit, club.
She's at the Wilford Theater. The Wilford. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's in pain and she's, yeah.
Well, that just shows how much Moishe, you know, you stick to your deal. I expect these payments at a certain time. And she's so laissez-faire. I can't pay this time. Yeah. What are some of the phrases she uses? You know, these are not words in a contract.
Right.
Being a little late.
A skosh and a skosh. smidgen.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Then the head hits the table.
I mean, again, that wasn't in the stage direction. That was just a choice I made to put my hand in my head in my hand. Mm-hmm. And I just thought he can't take it. And she has exhausted him, was the notion.
Yeah. I mean, the conversation certainly in the writing, the pain that she's putting him through. And I had so little to contribute to the entire episode. It was just that one scene that I thought, how do I make this memorable?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Make this stick out. Don't you love phone call days?
Yep.
When you're doing phone calls.
Yeah.
There's just something fun. You're by yourself. But like I said, with Danny and Dan and Amy, the actor you're talking to is actually present.
Right.
And not in makeup and not in wardrobe, of course. But I love phone calls.
I love
when they're there, too. Yeah.
When
other end.
Yeah. They brought me in that day in my city's clothes, street clothes, mm-hmm. life clothes, and mm-hmm. sit there on that set while we saw Midge's side of the.
Yeah. I remember she didn't do it the first. I don't think they did it the first season, but I remember her saying, we're bringing in people for both sides of the phone call. She said, I just don't, it always feels false.
Yeah.
It always feels like these two people were shot at a different time, at separate times, and said, I don't want that anymore. And what Amy wants, Amy gets.
Right. Which is why I became a series regular in season two, because season one, I was a recurring mm-hmm. character. And as my dear friend and your co-star from The Late Bloomer, he's in a small scene, Brian Doyle Murray always says, oh, I love reoccurring. Yeah, they're always happy to see you.
It is true. It is true. Yeah.
He too from the Illinois.
Yeah, he is. He's from Chicago, of the Murrays.
Family. Nine
yep.
Murrays.
Yep.
Two nuns came out of.
Are the two
of,
girls? Yeah, look, the two girls become nuns. Were there more than two girls?
No, I don't think so.
No. I know Joel the best. He was my contemporary.
Nine of nine.
Oh, he is?
That's his moniker.
Yeah, nine of nine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And he's a big golfer now, too.
Yeah.
He loves to golf.
Oh, my goodness.
I follow him on Instagram.
On the Instagram. Yeah, same here. Mostly from the course. The photos he posts.
Yeah.
So we were talking earlier about Boise being the mafia guy. In this scene from Midge's side of the wolf, we go into a conversation at a table where Boise is getting the third degree from definitely mobbed up bosses of his.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Their the characters.
Dames.
Yeah. Mario is one of them. Yeah. And Boise's complaining about the wrong client type of clientele that Midge is bringing in.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of defends herself, saying, you know,
we're making more money. And yeah. And
then the mobbed up guys almost seemingly against their better wishes.
Yeah.
The numbers are, you know.
The numbers are great. That guy's great. I love him because he doesn't really have an opinion.
Nope.
You know, about the dames or not the dames. He says, look, we're making a lot of money. And then the bartender goes, yeah, but they want banana daiquiris and little umbrellas. He says, well, we're going to get you the umbrellas. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Whatever
it's
takes.
Just numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
He's comics like will talk about having to work in a venue that was mobbed up. Did you ever in your...
Not that I know. I've never done stand-up, but...
No, but in your touring...
Done things at clubs and touring... I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I bet you have because you're a stand-up guy.
Well, Kansas City, for sure. Infamously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I meant to ask at the top and I didn't, so I'm going to do it now. How was your recent tour over the holidays?
It was great. And, you know, it's wonderful. The only thing that was bothersome for me is I blew out my voice in the second show.
Oh, no.
I know. I have a little bit of asthma. And I wasn't getting enough breath. And so anyway, we had to change the show just a little bit, but it was a really good show. So thank you. We did about 16 shows. I just didn't do any solos because I lost my belt. But all was good. You know, Kate Flannery.
Oh, yeah. Love her.
She's a wonderful singer and she's one of my best friends. And I don't know if you know this, but her dad turned 100 on December 17th and he passed away 2 days ago.
Oh, no.
Like he
made it to 100.
He made it to 100. And then
said, check, please.
And very consciously,
yeah,
you know, said, this is it.
I'm good.
Done. Yeah. Yeah. And she's loves him so much. It was one of the most beautiful relationships I've ever seen in my life.
Well,
Kate Flannery and her dad. Just yeah. So RIP, Tom.
When you speak to her next, please extend my condolences and all my love and strength are now hers. But the tour went well otherwise.
It went
the
really
the
well.
Two of you have a ball. I know that.
We do. We have a blast. And for those who don't know, it's called the Swingin' Little Christmas Tour. We actually have an album. And it's late 50s, early 60s kind of jazz. We have a five-piece band, Tony Guerrero Quintet. And we all adore each other. And we do Christmas songs that we put kind of in the big band kind of era.
Yeah.
Kind of jazzy. And it's a lot of fun. And Kate is absolutely impulsive and unpredictable.
Great.
And so much fun. And I pretend to be her Eve Arden to her Kay Ballard.
Oh, nice. And how many cities? You said 16.
We did about probably 10 cities.
Yeah.
Some of the shows were two shows. We did Joe's Pub in New York.
Oh, wow.
And that's where I blew my voice out. We did two shows a day. But after the first day, I was like popping steroids. And yeah. So that was a drag. But
so folks, around the holidays, certainly here in the States, look for...
We've already scheduled the tour for 2024. So.
And it will have the same title that people can look for.
Yeah, Swingin' Little Christmas. Yeah, and you can always go to my website, which is Jane Lynch Official.
Great.
Yeah.
And order the album.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
After that scene with Boise, we go to a newspaper office. I kept watching and rewinding and watching, and it's not clear which newspaper. Maybe a listener can write in, as they like to do. My Mrs. Mazelpod at gmail.com. Love to hear from you. And we meet the copywriter, L. Roy Dunham.
Right.
Portrayed by Harry Neff.
I thought maybe. Is Harry a he? A trans?
It's our first trans.
Well, I wonder. Actor. She was wonderful.
Let's say they.
They?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't want to get canceled. I'm sure that Harry would be fine if I
me too.
Screwed up on that.
If not flattered.
I just said how talented he was.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah. And the scene is so perfect. You know, we talked earlier about our interactions with fans and our appreciation of them, but also the awkwardness therein. The other side of that is our, if lucky and success is a guarantee of some sort of existence, not relationship, with critics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I certainly developed early on I had heard and agreed to don't read the good ones, don't read the bad ones. But then also, just as a cinephile, I would read a review of a film that I liked.
Sure.
And the review would be even a wonderful essay from the great Janet Maslin. Is that her name? Jane
sure,
Maslin?
Yeah, yeah. That was New York Times, right?
Yeah. And I would think, you know, if it's a great essay, wonderful. And then all the other critics, and now thanks to the internet, everyone has a voice and an opinion. You know, if I want your opinion about the film, let it be directions to the theater. could I just get that? Is that possible?
Yeah.
But here, Midge goes out of her way to go to a newspaper office and confront.
I love that she did that.
Yes.
I forgot that she did. And now I saw her walking down the hall. I was like, she's at the fucking newspaper.
Yes. And then as much as I initially, like we're supposed to, loathed the copywriter, L. Roy Dunham, I came to appreciate even that person's position, because it ends with Midge saying, you know how hard it is to do what I do in a man's world. And then L. Roy's response ultimately is in a snarky way to say, imagine how hard it is to do what I do in a man's world. And I got that guy's desk because I write trash about you.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting women in a man's world, but also sometimes we're not going to be able to support each other.
No. And also, you know, I mean, I walked away going, what a bitch.
Sure.
What a horrible thing, you know, to... And people, that's what media is these days, you know, especially now that we're 24/7 and the the beast continues to want to be fed.
Yep.
So you have to come up with things. So I'm sure people are writing things about other people all the time that they're just doing it because they know it'll get clicks. And
yeah. Now I say Harry Neff because it's spelled H-A-R-I. It might be Harry.
H-A-R-I.
It might be Harry. Harry Neff.
Might have they might have been born Harry and perhaps changed.
That would track. Anyways, but kudos, and thank you.
Yeah, real well. Well done. I have this quote here in front of me about critics that I
Oh, please.
When I found it, I just loved it. This is George O'Keefe. "I've already settled it for myself. So flattery and criticism go down the same drain and I am quite free."
Oh, wow. That's George O'Keefe.
Yeah. "I've settled it for myself." So both they all go down the same drain.
"I've settled it for myself" says it all.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, haven't we?
Yep.
I mean, where we are at this point as at our age and having been at this for a while. And
yep.
I mean, you have to have a certain amount of not thick skin, but thick skin there's no place for like a negative review to land in me. And I don't even know if I've ever gotten one because I don't read them. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Unless somebody sends me something, "Look what so-and-so said about you. It's nice." But again, it does go down a drain. I don't hold on for it a second more.
Yeah. It's also on a need to care basis.
Yeah.
And you'll know I'm interested in your opinion on this when I ask for it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The unsolicited.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, but also, I mean, you're talking about just like critics and stuff when you're not asking critics. But I remember I did a one-person show in 1999 with like three other people. But I wrote it myself. And it was a bunch of monologues I had been doing at comedy clubs, you know, in characters, not stand-up.
Right.
And I kind of wove it into a thing. And I was very proud of it. And I didn't want anybody to help me with it. It was definitely my voice. I didn't want anybody to come in, and I didn't show people the work before I did it. Mm. But I remember I walked into a casting session after a casting director had seen it. I walked into a commercial casting place and she said, "I saw your show." And she said, "I have a couple of notes."
Oh, no.
And I went,
"Oh, no,
I don't really." "No, no, no. It is what it is." "Oh, okay."
I love that you shut it down.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good.
Even at that, you know, that tender stage of my career too, I knew better than to, you can't possibly have a note that is going to help me with this.
Yeah.
I'm in charge of this whole thing and I meticulously created it.
Yes. Can you imagine?
And you saw it once and went, and that's okay. You can have your opinion. And maybe it would be better, but it wouldn't be my show anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, imagine the level of narcissism.
I know. To feel like you have to put your mark on somebody.
To be sitting there thinking, well, this is good, but it'd be so much better if.
And that, you know, I could go into the psychology of the person who said it, but most people, especially in the like the commercial world, commercial casting world, it's like the lowest.
Mm-hmm.
Of this business, you know, which up here is like the Meryl. Well, she's not even the biggest star anymore. I'm dating myself, but this is like your A-listers in movies and television's up there now too. But then commercials is the people who work and like the casting and stuff. They don't have the gravitas of the people who are, you know, casting movies and stuff like that. So it's kind of punching down.
Yes,
you notice that, like you see it on TV. Sets too with the crew. Like sometimes people are so mean to the PAs, and they're the people who are like just slightly above because there's a hierarchy, you know,
sure.
on film crew, and everybody does their job, and nobody's getting in anybody else's lane. But
right.
if you are above, you have some power where you can, and if you want to, you can punch down.
Yeah, and that's also often driven by insecurity. Why would
Absolutely. That's all it is.
Yeah.
That's all it is. I feel beaten up in some way, and maybe they are, or maybe they're just one of those people who are, you know, perpetually on a victim loop.
Yes.
To punch down on like a like especially the DGA, who's that, the DGA intern or whatever, they're the absolute lowest.
Yes.
They're like in training to become a PA.
That's right.
And oh,
let's cut sometimes. Them a break.
Yeah.
The very next scene is that one you were talking about earlier where Midge comes home, and as soon as she gets off the elevator out in the hallway, she can hear Sophie's voice and people laughing. And it's a very brief moment before we're inside, but Rachel does definitely play that beat of, that's not what I think it is. Is it?
Yeah.
It can't be. Yeah. It all happens very quickly. And then
she's
we're
just
inside.
Coming off the scene with her parents who are saying that, you know, Sophie's the new chaplain.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and there you are.
Mm-hmm.
Even again, the little cutaway to Dawes standing there. Really? Yeah.
And I said, I'm in her house. I said, would you like something to drink? and she said, it's my house. And I go, Dawes, nothing, please. Thank you.
And I just love they had him come in, had Stephen come in for that. And I'm sure he loved
that
it.
Just that one too. Moment. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He loved it because he knew how funny and absurd he was, gets mm-hmm. to be a part of that comedic beat.
Yeah.
But then very quickly, Sophie does her own little walk and talk throughout the home. And
right.
And I'm just curious about any memories of shooting that particular day, because it's just delicious. And
it is.
Yeah.
Well, what I love about it is that Sophie knows to the penny Midge's financial situation.
Yes.
She knows that she still owes $200 to the dry cleaner.
And why does she know?
She got invested. She probably has Dawes investigate all these things. Who knows?
She says in the scene she hired a private investigator.
Oh, did I say? She hired a private investigator. She knows that the fridge is on the blink. She knows she knows what bad shape Midge is in, and she knows how desperate she is.
Yeah.
And so why is she offering to take her out of this desperation? I think it's twofold. It's to smush her face into how well I'm doing, and also it's to get Susie. She needs, just psychologically, how she needs Dawes for the window dressing.
Yep.
She needs Susie in her life to tell her.
Yep.
It's almost like sadomasochism.
Yeah. And the gift basket.
Nobody talks to Sophie the way Susie does.
Right. That's why she wanted her.
Nobody. Yeah. That's why she talks down to her. She yells at her. She tells her the truth. She gets into the depths of her psychology and into the insecurity.
Yeah.
And Sophie likes being seen that way.
Yes.
It's the most real thing she has in her life.
Yeah. I don't know that they ever wrote in any of the scripts, any of the scenes, any of the dialogue for you to do as Sophie, wherein you say those thoughts in character, mm-hmm. how you just perfectly articulated why Sophie is going after Susie. But it's there. It mm-hmm. is
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I don't think I do. Yeah, it's there. Yeah, it's there. And I think the scene that we have outside of the theater after I just choke doing Miss Julie, mm-hmm. and I revert to like my old tricks and I become the Sophie, the housewife.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I break completely break character, ruin the show. Yeah. And I am running away from Susie. I don't want her. I like get my flowers and on stage. And then I see her and she's like, and so I run out of the theater. And then she chases me to the front and Susie has it out with me.
The dressing down.
This. Yeah, tells the absolute truth. You were on the verge of becoming a great actress, and you are a great actress, and you were on the verge of showing the world, and you choked.
Yeah.
And Sophie can barely stand it, but she ultimately wants that.
Yeah.
She wants that kind of truth. It's going after Susie is probably the healthiest thing in life.
Interesting. It is. It absolutely is. In fact, maybe the only glimpse.
Mm-hmm. She might look at herself.
Yeah.
She might. She almost did it.
Right.
She almost did. And even Susie said, you came this close.
Right.
You were that close.
And
she did. Yeah.
She was on the precipice. In fact, I had Carrie L. was on on the podcast as well. Speaking about
the best.
Speaking about those scenes you guys got to do.
Yeah.
It's certainly off topic of this episode, but who cares? I loved all of those scenes so much that I, like the audience, must know that they were deliciously fun to do.
Oh, absolutely. Just so good. And, you know, as an actor, and I think actors probably would get a kick out of watching what happened in rehearsal, especially. Remember I was talking about the divas who are so insecure, and especially the ones that are, you know, past their prime.
Yeah.
And that's what Sophie's going through. Yeah. Whereas Carrie's character is still kind of a, you know, he's probably a little younger and he's still good looking and he's still got it. And she, Sophie, cannot help but sabotage herself.
Right.
And the rehearsal, she just can't. She just can't. Her insecurities are so big. And you can, hopefully, you saw it. You can see it in her face. Even while she's reading the lines.
Yeah.
The
fear of failure.
She has to just stop. And Dawes comes in with a lemon.
Yeah.
And where's my lemon? It's that I always say there's sometimes there are people on a set who are not content unless they're inconveniencing others.
That's right.
And that's what Sophie is doing.
Show of strength, I was just going to say.
Yeah. Who's the dominant thing.
Right.
And you kind of just let them do it. It's like Rip Torn. You let them have their thing because, it's Rip Torn. You're not going to fire them. Maybe you'll never hire them again. But you got to let them get through it. And hopefully there will be a point where it turns around.
Right.
And we can get some work done. And so, and here's, you know, Carrie's character is just, you know, kind of doing that, going, this will end. Let's give it 10 minutes.
Yeah. Even the rehearsal
scenes.
Now we can
get back to work.
The rehearsal scenes are great for what you're saying, and also the scenes of you guys on the stage in the opening night, when the turn begins, where we're sensing Sophie is cracking under the pressure, and they have a few shots of Carrie's character's reaction, which also is a slow build, where he's first in denial. You see
that didn't happen.
Right. Everything's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine.
She'll recover. We're moving.
Yeah. When you shot the stuff from the play, was it shot all in pieces? Did they allow you to do a little bit more of the scene?
No. I don't remember what was in there. But we staged it like a play.
Right.
And
rehearsed
there
it.
Was that. Yeah. There was like a, for the performance, there was actually a camera way in the back. So you got the whole stage. So you saw the whole thing. So that was one of those shots. And we had our pattern, our traffic patterns were like blocking for a stage.
Yes.
We didn't really block for camera. We blocked it as a stage. Yeah, so that's what it was a Broadway theater. I think it was the Barrymore Theater.
Yeah.
Which was so much fun to do. And again, with the background and the perfect wardrobe, it was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I was just dying to know. It was as I had hoped.
Good.
What you described, which is,
I loved working with Carrie. He's just the greatest. He's
truly
a good actor and really the nicest guy.
Right. And so so perfectly cast.
Yeah. Again, another perfect. Yeah. Perfect pitch pass casting.
Back into the episode, and we're almost done here. We're into the Button Club. That great set where
beautiful
Susie and Joel are waiting for Alfie, the magician, to show up. It's a bit tense. And then Stephanie Hsu, this great, wonderful actress who plays May, also shows up. The I'm pregnant of it all.
You know, what was so interesting, kind of sobering, was when we shot that, we still had Roe versus Wade in real life.
Right.
So she's talking about in 1960, she's pregnant. And of course, we're saying, well, getting a, 1959, she couldn't get an abortion if she wanted. I'm going all political here. I don't know. But yeah, it was kind of a shock.
No, that's so, there. That's yeah. there. Yeah.
But when we shot that, we still had Roe versus Wade.
Of course.
So it's just, yeah. It's like not so far away.
Right.
Oh, that happened back then.
Right. And again.
And seen in Texas.
And then we're in Chinatown. I mentioned this scene, especially to go back to the set design,
yeah.
the stage, you know, the design, the production design
of Chinatown was,
you know, Chinatown's there, but you still need to make it 1960 Chinatown.
Right.
And they do. And mm-hmm. it's delicious and wonderful. And one of those bonuses that happens when your budget is made of, you know, the money that fell out of Bezos' pocket that morning, yeah. which is ample.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, every penny was spent so perfectly, you know, it was,
right.
They had the best of the best. And like we said earlier, there never is a moment where Amy and Dan say, well, it's fine. Good enough.
I never thought of
people that way too. Yeah. And as I do that all day long, I do that in my work too. So it's fine. It's good enough. but you look at the people that they chose to work for too,
yes.
our set designer and Donna,
yeah.
our wardrobe designer. Oh my God. The thought the creativity.
Yes.
And the character work.
Yes.
That she puts into your stuff. And we have talks about
right.
where I figure she's blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's
pretty
so
amazing.
True. Yeah, I had Bill Groom, our production designer, on the podcast, and to hear him walk through his process, and then I had Donna on to talk about that.
Oh, great!
And she put out a book, which if you don't have, needs to be on that ottoman behind you,
because
it's a great photos and dissertation about all the looks for all the characters throughout the season.
Oh, great. Great.
All right, so Susie's office, Sophie has found her way back into Susie's good graces through Midge. Midge convinces Alex, and what Alex as Susie goes through to agree to take her back is a kind of a beautiful, mm-hmm. you know, coming to realization.
Yeah.
And then... that Brighton Beach restaurant that Rose goes to meet the other Yentas. We know
Bishop.
It's Brighton Beach because as she comes through the door, I noticed in production sound design, they put in the sound of seagulls very briefly in the background, as just as the door opens for her to enter this establishment, and then they're gone.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And then, of course, she walks in and says, you know, so nice to be here in Brighton Beach. But we already got the sense we were near the shore.
Yeah.
And all that's played out great, as we said, by Kelly Bishop and Jackie Hoffman.
I know her from Second City. We were there at the same time. We did some touring together.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
She is something. She is a piece of work and so talented. And
yeah,
she's been doing really, really good for herself.
Always great.
Yeah.
And then as I want to give credit also, Marceline Hugo or Hugot as Molly and Patrice Johnson as Miss M. All the actors in the scene are just spectacular.
Yeah, really good. Really good.
Especially handling that dialogue, which can be tricky. And the pace.
Kelly Bishop, my gosh.
Oh,
she
crushes.
She was everything.
Yeah. And then our final scene, thankfully, is in the TV studio. That scene we spoke of just briefly, and I want to go into a little bit more about the nature of playing Sophie to this end, which is Midge is the warm-up comic. And if you've not seen a warm-up comic or heard about it, folks, it's an actual profession, and they mm-hmm. do quite well in front of sitcoms and game shows and any sort of audience taped in front of a live audience situation. Yeah. And they really do throw candy and have mm-hmm. little things. It's on paper a hellish gig, but Midge.
Have you ever done it? No.
I didn't, but I've been to live tapings and have seen them in action and thought,
too.
Oh, you poor bastard.
Yeah. They usually, but, I mean, they're always good. I think they're always good.
I've
seen a bad. They really, they're to keep the audience alive and keep them entertained and
keep it lively.
They're usually really kind of like affable people.
Very. And Midge, perfectly written that she succeeds quickly and easily. And it makes sense because, as we already know and has been established, her best on stage comedy is off the cuff. It is talking about what's happening right then and there in the moment.
Yeah.
Including her very debut in the pilot when she stumbles on stage with a bottle of Manischewitz. So it's her first day as a warm-up comic on Seconds Count, but it will also be her last day because, of course,
she's good.
Sophie notices right away she's getting too many laughs.
What's all that laughing?
Yeah.
What was she thinking?
Yeah, she just wanted Susie back and diabolically figured out this is how I'll do it. And in fact, it worked.
Yeah.
Getting
Midge she's too good at it.
But then she didn't factor in, God damn, that bitch is good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, again, in the writing, as this runner, starting with Susie getting gifts in her office, and it all culminates in this final scene of the episode. You know, that arc of careful what you wish, careful what you want. Yeah. Oh, man. And so on the day when you guys are doing... they kind of go at each other,
right?
Doing riffs, making fun of each other's character. And it gets all too real. That must have been some fun.
That was a blast. And there's a scene where she kind of bumps me out of the way. She literally knocked me down.
Oh, no.
And I end up like almost in a guy's lap.
Yes.
I lost my balance.
That happened on the day.
That happened on the day. And they used, they would have been crazy not to use it.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm like literally in a guy's lap.
Yeah. It was uncomfortable to watch. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I assumed it was choreographed.
Yeah. No, it was basically choreographed, but that was not.
Yeah.
I fall down and go boom.
Yeah. But perfect. The back and forth of it.
Oh, it worked. Yeah. 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 Really great. Very well written too. The topping each other and, you know, doing like five back and forth.
Yeah.
Joke about trying to beat each other on why this woman's red hair is too high.
Yes, yes.
Her hair is so high, the altitude is blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, her hair is so high that it can be seen from space.
Yeah. Culminating in it's as high as Sophie at last night. Or
on
in the
Tuesday night right now. Right, exactly.
There is a little cutaway from what you are two are up to into the hallway of this television studio where Susie confronts the Mike Carr producer of the Gordon Ford show.
Gordon Ford, yes.
Mike Carr, brilliantly portrayed by Jason Ralph. I would end up sitting next to him at table reads whenever that character was in the show. And, you know, I knew him as a dramatic actor. And of course, sidebar, husband to Rachel Brosnahan, but a wonderful dramatic actor like Rachel. So when I would see him initially reading at the table, read these the pace and you know, all the Palladino's comedic genius.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, they're brilliant at casting. He just nails it.
Nails it. Yeah, he does.
He's
such a contemptuous kind of... he doesn't have to do anything. He's just...
Yep. It's that look of, why are you still in front of me?
Yeah.
To Susie.
Yeah.
But so that scene with you and with Sophie and Mitch just culminates in, as I said, is the perfect arc of this episode.
Yeah.
And and then you wanted to talk about the song that they play at the end, the contemporary.
Oh, yes. So, you know, we're having this back and forth. Topping each other and we're angry. And the very last shot is me being pulled off by my assistant, pulled off because I'm about to kill her. And Midge does a mic drop.
Yes.
All the 1960 mic drop. Then all of a sudden, why can't we be friends? Yes. Why can't we be friends?
Yes.
Isn't that great?
It's so good.
Perfect. Like a 1974 song, 75, something like that.
The perfect needle drop. Yeah. Oh, goodness. I have kept you way too long, but thank you for seemingly wanting to be here for every moment.
Oh, I did. I enjoyed every moment. So thank you so much, Kev. It's so great to see you and to talk with you and to do this back and forth thing.
Yeah.
You're the best.
I have one last item. We have people write in to my Mrs. Mazapod at gmail.com. And I invite them to ask any questions of a member of the cast or the crew or anybody. So here's one that came in for you, if you don't mind answering it. It's from Steve. And it reads, hope you have Jane Lynch on the show soon. I'm anxiously waiting for her appearance to talk about all things Sophie, as well as any and all inspirations that Jane and the Palladinos had for Sophie. Part of me wonders if the stark dichotomy of the high-class brow Sophie Lennon and her hard-scrabble Queens residing gimmick character was, in fact, a little inspired by similarly performer named Sarah Colley, who achieved fame with her hard-scrabble stage persona, Minnie Pearl, from Steve. So I thought that was a possibility as well, but we covered this answer
Energetically to me, my impulse was Phyllis Diller. But Phyllis Diller's persona is nothing like Sophie from Queens. I loved women comics back in those days, like in the early 60s. Those are the characters I grew up with. She's also a little like Kay Ballard, just kind of the loud and you had to have a gimmick back then. You had to be, had to be about, I can't get a date. I'm ugly. I'm fat. It all had to be from the point of view of what you think a man wants to see a woman say. And that's what's so wonderful about Midge. She doesn't have a gimmick. She's an observational comic and she's self-deprecating. We hadn't seen her like. She didn't have that kind of I'm stupid, fat and ugly thing going on, because she's not. She's right. Just funny.
Perfect answer. There you go.
Sure. And also, let me say to Steve, please. who wrote that, that was a beautifully written question.
Right?
Wasn't it? Just really beautifully written. I don't know that I answered it precisely, but I answered it within the neighborhood.
You were kind enough to answer it and articulate your position on the matter, which I don't think Steve could ask for more.
Oh, well, great. I just want Steve to be happy.
That's what I wrote down here. all right. Now I will say thank you very much, Jane Lynch, for spending a couple of hours, as it turns out, of your day with us. And I'm just going to invite Jamie and I to come visit you as soon as possible.
Oh, you must. And I'm serious. You must. We got a little bit of a guest house over there.
Hello.
We'd love to have you.
Oh.
We'll take a walk to the beach. And I'm serious. I would love it. Love it if you two came out.
Okay, I'm going to pester you in text until we find a date.
Please do. Please do.
Okay, right. Godspeed and be well.
Thank you,
And again, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for asking.
Oh, love you.
Love you too.
Okay.
Bye, Kev.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I love that ending. How about that? Steve, I hope you got the answers that you wanted to your fan mail question to Jane Lynch. And boy, oh boy, as promised, she really does share the intricacies and inner workings of Sophie Lennon's insecurities. But also, I loved how she talked about how Susie's the only one who could tell Sophie how it all really is, and therefore is the most important person to her. Towards the end or whatever, as Jane relives the scene at the TV station where Sophie and Midge go at each other. God, I just love it. Love, love, love it. I also wanted to answer the moment where I was about to explain why, after Jane says what Amy wants, Amy gets, and I said, yes, that's why I ended up being a series regular in season two, because I was only reoccurring in season one. I don't know. I hope I haven't shared this inner working. So when the time came between season one and two shooting, as the show was picked up for two, when my agent and lawyer called, as they do when it's about negotiation when they're on the phone together. Yeah, so Kevin, you have in fact been asked to be reoccurring again in season two. And, you know, here's the bits of the deal. And I said, well, you know, I'm hoping to direct this film during the time that the show will be produced. And so the only thing that would stop me from directing the film is if they were to make me a series regular. I don't know that I could choose being reoccurring over directing this movie. And within days, the message got back to me from Amy that I, in fact, would be a series regular because, quote, I get what I want from Amy in regards to me in this case. And it was one of the single most joyous moments for me in the entire experience of being on the show. Also a lesson. I'd always heard and have implemented a few times that the word no is the most powerful word in any negotiation, but in show business in particular. And when meant sincerely, as it was in this case, is even more powerful. In terms of maybe getting what you actually wanted. And so, yeah, I thought that should be shared with any artist hopefuls out there listening to this. Aside from the art that we get to participate in, there's a business side, show business. So there you go. All right. Continue to write to us, please. My Mrs. Mazepod at gmail.com. Please tell everyone you've ever met. Thank you to Jane Lynch. And thank you to you for being with us for these episodes. Next up, wildly excited to share two parts with a character we touched on, Jane and I, Santino Fontana, the Tony Award winning, who played Boise at the Wilford Theater scenes. The gentleman who runs the joint, the character who runs the place, and he's a brilliant fella. And I'm excited for you to hear those two parts. That'll be next. Okay. Until then, be kind to each other, please, and I'll see you in my dreams. Okay, closing credits time. My Mrs. Maisel Pod was created by me, your host, Kevin Pollack, research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and our engineer, recording, post-production producer genius is Ken Plume. My Mrs. Maisel Pod is brought to you by the fine folks at Q-Code. Q-Code. Sounds like something, doesn't it? Oh, lastly, you should know, I'm told by legal to make this crystal clear, that my Mrs. Maisel Pod was not sanctioned in any way, shape, or form by Amazon Prime, nor the show's creators Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, although I feel the need to mention I did get their blessing. Okay, good. That should save me some legal.
On a summer night, Douglas Wagg Jr. lay motionless across a strip of railroad tracks before being struck by an oncoming train. I'm investigative journalist Delia D'Ambra, and my investigation into exactly how Doug died took me into the depths of a bizarre mystery.
It was really hard to understand what was fact and what wasn't.
A mystery that has led me from one suspicious death to another. Listen to Counterclock now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Everyone needs a break from the real world. That's why we played games as kids, and that's why we should play games as adults. I'm Troy LaValle.
And I'm Joe O'Brien. And back in 2015, we started a podcast called The Glass Cannon Podcast, a show made up of comedians and actors playing a fantasy role-playing game.
And now is the perfect time to start listening because we just started a brand new story.
It's basically Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones meets X-Files.
Search for The Glass Cannon Podcast on your podcast app of choice. Hey, life is hard, so come play pretend with us.
Welcome to a journey into the heart of the Texas Renaissance Festival, the nation's largest and rowdiest celebration of medieval fantasy. But what lurks beneath the facade of tights and turkey legs? Well, we dove deep into the empire to uncover a history marred by mystery and misconduct, murders, assaults, and other crimes that tarnish its legacy. This isn't just a fairy tale. It's a cautionary tale of power, fantasy, and the consequences that follow when they all collide. Search for Crime Waves Renaissance Texas on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.